Actually, you know, the truth is, I think it was this. I don't remember, maybe the first one or the second one. First, I was at in the TV, you know, building that I'm in, which is a big building with big staircase and people who think of themselves as big people and have that sort of swagger that TV people have. And I came to this convention when it was downtown, and it was filled with people who I think wanted to be big people, but they hadn't quite figured out the swagger yet, you know, so. And I was thinking, as I was looking at them, this would be the 3-4 generations earlier than you, and I was thinking, oh man, I really like these people. And in my inner self, when I go up the staircase, you know, with all the pictures of Ted Koppel 15 feet high and Peter Jennings and all, and then, you know, you go to the NPR one with the little teeny pictures, that it seemed to suit me a little bit to go into a little room that looks sort of like a college radio station with people who were drooling and doing other unpolite things, than to go into the places where all the swashbucklers were. Although it's fun to be with the swashbucklers, I think I discovered in this room downtown in Chicago the first time that my heart actually belongs with us. And so I decided then, 4 years ago, or five, whenever it was, 5 years ago? Four, five, that I just didn't want to die alone. So so I did. Then I found Jad Abumrad, who's my partner in the Radiolab program, and he reminded me all over again what it's like to gamble. When I went back to NPR, I was warned that they weren't going to be gamblers there. They'd stopped gambling a long time ago. But curiously, I think the good news, at least so far, that I found, is that yes, there is a quality of a matureness with all of that there, but there is also an awful lot of people trapped in the building who want to breathe freely, like, you know, like one of those lionesses from the Born Free movies. And they're everywhere, roaming around the building and anxiously dreaming of being open-hearted and open-minded and full of excitement. And so I find NPR just pregnant, actually. It sounds a little quiet, I admit, but it's inside. It's quite a lively place with a tremendous amount of yearning. And when I was walking around today briefly, I did see, when I went into a couple of sessions, I noticed that same, when I was looking at the sea of people writing everything down, and you know, it was like a set of sponges, basically, just going, whoop! To all this, and I love that. I love the sense that you come to your work with a feeling of covetousness and envy and all kinds of dark things like, I want to do this, I want to do that better than him, I can do that. That whole sense of wanting to swallow the whole thing up and eat it and then be bigger in the morning feeling. Which this conference really does very well, I think. And so I'm very happy to be here. This topic I was told was to find things that I love, and it's true that when you turn on the radio, whether it's commercial radio, television radio, or TV, there is this sort of noise that comes at you, which is the sort of same old noise that the companies are all famous for. So you have the commercial radio sound. And then they have the FM, the sort of NPR radio sound, which is just as distinctive and has this slightly sophisticated, semi-omniscient air. So... And that's fine. That's what these companies stand for in a way. But then every so often, from within this sort of sound that you hear, there's this suddenly, and for different people it can be different things, but suddenly some sound just sort of steps out. It could be someone's voice, it could be someone's passion showing, it could be some particularly beautiful construct that somebody made. And suddenly, it's like some invisible voice kind of steps out of the radio and taps you very specifically on the shoulder and says, "Listen to me." And then you just turn and you find yourself noticing. And the magical thing of that, of what it is that makes me notice, I chose a few. For me, I like danger. I mean, I have always. never fit in particularly anywhere, ABC or anywhere else. CBS, I remember Dan Rather saying, you can come onto my hurricane special, but I don't want you to bring any balloons. I thought, what? I said, well, what have I ever brought a balloon? He said, well, you know what I mean by balloons, like those kind of things. I said, oh. So I know that I don't quite fit the mold, but I every so often you run into people, and Ellen, the person I work with at Radio Lab, told me to check out this guy, Sean Cole, from WBUR, whom I'd heard of, but I didn't. So I just went and downloaded stuff, and I wrote him, and he sent me some other things. And I noticed that there was something astonishing. It's very hard to begin anything, to begin a piece on the radio or on TV. Because, you know, your hello is a very important moment. It's sort of like in eighth grade, it's like stepping from the boys' section to the girls' section and asking somebody to dance. It's fraught with all kinds of, what should I do? How do I do this? And Sean, he's beyond saving, actually. For example, he was sent by, I think it was Studio 360, to do a piece on a piece of art in which you had to, the way you would appreciate the piece of art is you'd go to sleep in it, in apparently the exhibition space. So how many people would actually learn to appreciate a sculpture by going to sleep in it all night, I'm not sure. That'd probably be, if the thing ran for 21 days, they'd lucky, I'm sure, if they got 10 appreciators. But Sean was sent, and so you wonder, like, how do you start a story like this? Well, you could say, well, I was sent to the... So can we just run the very, very beginning of this? This is Sean going... First, you'll hear the host introducing him.
Lots of artists have depicted their dreams in paintings and novels and films, but Marina Abramović makes your dreams the center of her work. She recently installed a piece called Dream Bed at the Rose Museum outside Boston. She invited visitors to lie down inside the dream bed and then record whatever happened. WBUR Sean Cole decided to stop in and take a nap.
Check, 1, 2, 3.
Now, how many times do you hear a piece go... I just said, whoa, what was that? You know, and I mean, it's true that if you might do to be heard, I mean, that was what you do if there were two people talking and you wanted to interrupt them, you like, I'm here. But I'd never heard that. And then the next little section right after his cough is some kind of private soliloquy where he, as a reporter, is thinking, how am I going to do this? I can't do this. Am I going to be able to go to sleep? Just listen to this. It's a little... It's like a parenthesis after the cough.
Check, 1, 2, 3. I'm worried that I'm going to get to the museum and that I'm not going to dream anything. Moreover, what if I can't even fall asleep?
You go, hello, hello, this is a radio show. I remember once I was doing I was doing a piece, it was in the morning, one of the breakfast shows, and I was hosting it, and they'd brought a pet. It was one of those, you know, you can bake, you can talk to the Secretary of State, they bring in a funny animal. So they brought in a burrowing rat of some sort, maybe it was a ferret. And so I had the ferret, I'm fine with animals, and I'm petting the ferret, and then I'm talking to the person, and the ferret used the opportunity to go up my sleeve into my underarm area, where it began nestling and tickling me. And... I lost all sense that I stopped paying attention to the person next to me, and I began looking at the ferret, and I'm looking at my underarm, and of course, as anyone tuning in at this point wouldn't know what was going on, because there was nothing happening except the man looking at his underarm and pulling at his underarm, and the guy in the earphone said, "Robert, you are not watching television; you are on television." And I think Sean. Sean gets close to that. So he's begun the piece coughing, counting, and then worrying to himself whether this is worthy of his time or something. And you know, you think, like, do you know that you're on? And then here's what happens next, I think.
So we'll see what happens.
We'll see what happens.
I recorded that around midnight, the night before I got into the dream bed. Then I went to sleep and dreamt nothing, not that I remember. The next day, I went over to the museum, still worrying. Curator Rafaela Plato did her best to be sympathetic.
I wish I could take the pressure off of you. I can only tell you, try to relax. If you don't sleep, you don't sleep.
So the piece begins with the person he's supposed to interview consoling him about his reporting assignments. In the next story I found, described a situation that happens on and immediately after the Thanksgiving holiday. He was interested in plumbers because apparently among the plumbing community, Thanksgiving is a very big day, just as it is at retail. The difference being that the plumbers have to solve problems that are caused on Thanksgiving. The problems are that people cook too much and then have to throw away, and sometimes they forget about the, I mean, in New York City we don't have those things, but you know what are those things, you put it in the drain and it chops it up, whatever those are called. Disposals, right? Garbage disposals. So people put in chicken and turkey and stuffing, and they put in Drano and liquid plumber, and so all these things kind of become a kind of horrible soup, and then they get stuck in there, and then the plumbers are called, and they have to come and open up the plumber. Now, he had to begin this piece. Again, it's the beginnings where Sean gets, I think, in the most interesting trouble. For some reason, he decided that he ought to clear. He said, I'm going to be talking about plumbers, and you know what plumbers do, but this isn't going to be about what plumbers normally do. Well, what do plumbers normally do is they deal with a word you're just not allowed to mention. Now, the most awkward thing to do is say, let's talk about, ooh, I can't talk about that. And that's exactly the way he began the piece. Let's talk about, and then he said, can't talk about that. So here's how it starts.
Well, first of all, it's not because of, you know, how should I put it?
You know, excrement's kind of a weird word. Fecal matter is a little clinical. Waste is okay.
Anyway, it's not because of that. And Joe Wood of Hub Plumbing and Mechanical in Dorchester, Mass. Knows that's what you're thinking, because he says that's what everyone thinks when they hear the word plumber. I drove around with him to a couple of house calls earlier this month.
Right. Get you in the mood, I guess. So then he goes off, and you find out about how the plumbing, you know, what the plumbers do, and all the busyness of plumbers on Thanksgiving, and da da da. And now it's time for the piece to end. And he can't quite get rid of the thought that there probably are great poop stories too, but that wasn't our subject this time. And so he goes back to this very shy plumber and says, "Let's talk. Do we have any other stories?" Well, we could, but I don't like to say those. You know, talk about that. And then he then finishes the piece saying, let's talk about that, except that he uses this as an opportunity to totally blow up the show that he's a part of. Now, I know that Marketplace is a snarky kind of show, and it loves being bad, but this is beyond bad. Listen to what happens here. This is the end.
On the positive side, both Macca and John Wood of Hub Plumbing say there's a lot of cash in performing gastric bypass surgery on so many drain systems. Not to mention all the other problems. I mean, really, John Wood refused to mention them.
We're on radio here, so I don't want to get too descriptive in my stories. I could tell you lots of stories.
But I can just bleep stuff out, you know.
You can bleep stuff out? Oh, well, I really don't want to disgust your listener base.
They're listening to a business show. They're disgusted already.
Right, exactly. Who wants to spend their time doing that?
Yeah, I mean, that's just gross. In Boston, I'm Sean Cole from Marketplace.
So he finishes the piece saying, you know, we're, like, this place stinks, for want of a better word. I thought, God, I wondered whether they would air that, because it was on, you know, it was on, so I asked him, I said, did they air it? He goes, oh, yeah. Huh. So, I can you imagine trying to do that at CBS or something? I mean, it was impossible. There's another one where this is just like, it's kind of like magical thinking. The American Express Company decided to release a credit card in the Boston area, specifically in the Boston area, called the Clear Card, which was kind of a metaphor. It would be clear in plastic, but that was just to suggest that your financial transactions would be so transparent that you would easily know how much you had and how much you owed, and it would all be just so clear. It was particularly marketed at Boston. Now, it was stupid, and it didn't mean any of the things, and it was, you know, a normal, stupid marketing story. But listen to how it starts.
American Express is crowing about its newest credit card program, just not loud enough for too many people to hear. Amex launched the first advertising push for its Clear Card in Boston and Dallas last week. The company says Bostonians in particular are looking for more clarity when it comes to finances. Amex says it knows this because it surveyed 400 Boston residents with questions like, are you looking for more clarity in your finances? Marketplace's Sean Cole saw the light.
See, because the card's called Clear, so they're like, are you looking for more clarity when it comes to finances? Get it? So, like, anyway, Amex did the survey back in February.
He just did a Southie accent for the fun of it, I guess. It has absolutely nothing to do with anything else. He can do accents. So can you say that one more time? I think it's the next one. I think I repeated it.
See, because the card's called Clear, so they're like, are you looking for more clarity when it comes to finances? Get it? So, like, anyway, Amex did the survey back in February.
There was another one. I won't play it to you, but there's another one where some person invented a clock that rang, an alarm clock that rang, and then leapt off the night table and moved at a safe distance from you and then rang again. And he opens it by saying, let me ask you a question. Why do you hate people? I think it's kind of neat that somebody has absolutely no superego at all. And there are other forms of danger, though, that have caught my eye. I think the most dangerous thing I ever saw, it wasn't me, this was back earlier in the NPR days in the beginning, and Richard Avedon came in to talk to an arts reporter who wasn't that swift. She was kind of a slow thinker, and she had all of her questions all sort of lined up. And Richard Avedon is a very intriguing, complex, and very, at the time, fairly self-loathing individual. And he had taken a series of photographs of his father who was dying of Alzheimer's disease. And the pictures, like many of Avedon's pictures, were extraordinarily intimate, in this case, troublingly so. And when you learned that it was his own father that he was examining in this cold sort of way, it was frightening that a son would look at his father that way. And the arts reporter didn't quite know, sense all this, I don't think. But she said to him, that was a part of the beginning of the quarter. And he, not really listening to the question, he suddenly looked up and he said, that wasn't my father. She didn't know what to think. She just sat there. Then he went, that wasn't my father. That wasn't my father. And then he got up and left. And I was like breathless. I'd never seen anything like that. I think he might have meant that my father in that mental state is not my father any longer. Maybe it wasn't his father. She didn't make a move, but I said to her, just keep that, start to build the whole thing around that, because it just was a moment that happened to her. One of them, in the same similar vein, although different, Starley Kine did a piece for Irish Show, which struck me as one of the more dangerous premises that I had ever heard. Starley, many of you have heard this piece, I'm sure. Starley had a mother and father who were unhappily married. The mother was apparently way over the top and did all kinds of bizarre things and was kind of a bit lost to intergenerational communication. But apparently, while they were growing up, she and her sister constantly would go to their father and to their mother and say, why are you guys still married? In fact, she begins the piece with the Parent Trap, with the theme from the Parent Trap, in which, as you may remember, two twin daughters try to do everything they can to bring their parents together. She and her sister would do everything they could to get their parents apart, including very frank, come on, you guys should really split sort of conversations from a very, very young age. So I don't know exactly how Ira works these things, but Starley apparently proposed that it would be interesting if she sat her father down, since he had finally gotten divorced, now that he was divorced, and say, what took you so long? Which, as a premise, I mean, in my own life, I would never, I mean, my parents, you know, had arguments, they weren't unhappily married, but the last thing in the world that I would do is go to my mom and my dad and say, so let's talk about your sex life or something like that. Ooh. And so when I heard this, here's how it opens. Let's just hear how it begins.
For years, the biggest mystery in my life was how these two people ever managed to end up together. But over time, that question was trumped by a much bigger one. Why they decided to stay together for so long. I can't really get the answer from my mom, because, to put it mildly, she's a little off kilter. She'd never been officially diagnosed with anything, but even so, she does a lot of things outside the realm of normal people. And over the years, her behavior has become much more extreme. So, that leaves my dad. All my life, I have urged my dad to leave my mom, to free himself of all the unhappiness and yelling and erratic behavior. But not only has my dad refused to end the marriage, he's refused to even acknowledge they had any problems. It wasn't until after the divorce finally went through this year that my dad was able to gain any perspective on his marriage. My dad agreed to talk to me on tape, to try and explain to me why he and my mom stayed together.
I'm thinking, what kind of a father would agree to talk to their daughter about this on tape? Like, maybe he's going to be one of these Oprah sort of confessional guys who's looking forward to the chance to say, well, blah, 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 and it's going to be one of these things where he's going to start to cry, and then she'll cry, and so forth. But when the phone rings in this next cut, you realize right away that this is not that kind of father at all. This is like a regular, ordinary, neurotic, you know, trying to be the best he can, private, oh my God, what is my daughter asking me to do, but I guess I should do it kind of father, which makes my heart bleed. But here's the ring and the hello. You'll see right away.
Here it comes. Hello.
Dad?
Hi, Starly.
I start off by asking him if there was ever a good time in their relationship, or was it really always as bad as I remembered it?
Nothing. Doesn't say anything.
It was always rocky from the start. I don't remember.
I don't remember. That means that's code for father. Code for I'm not telling you, you stupid ninny. But I mean, I don't know. Maybe you come from different families than mine. This is completely unkosher, this whole thing. So I'm just thinking ham going into this person's mouth, basically. So what does she do? She ups the ante. She goes, well, listen to this. She just goes, come on, tell me, give it up, sort of thing. He's not gonna. Here it goes.
Did it ever feel right, though, you and Mom?
I don't know.
Of course he doesn't know. Is that it? Is that my cut? Okay, so I'm filling here. So she presses it on. Basically, we can just run them together. She keeps pressing. She tries to come up with. First, her theory is that maybe I'm going to conclude that they had a bad marriage. She's going to have to agree with my conclusion, and that will somehow force the conversation open. But what you're hearing here is someone trying to pry open a lid that is really shut closed. Which, by the way, is a very, not in a bizarre situation like this, but it is a very ordinary situation if you're talking to generals, politicians. There's lots of times when you're not going to get it, you can't get it, but you keep hammering and hammering, hoping that maybe if you pour cold water on it or hit it on this faucet upside down, that somehow you'll open it up. So she does, first she does the dumb moves called, come on, kind of questions. Here's some more.
I mean, from my perspective, it never seemed right. I mean, it's a different perspective, but from what I've always witnessed from, like, a very, very, very young age, it never seemed like you guys were right for each other, ever. Do you remember, I remember lots of times when I was a kid, like, running into your office and trying to, like, tell you to, like, get a divorce. Do you remember any of that time?
I don't recall that at all.
Really?
So she's getting nowhere. So what she then comes up with is she comes up with a case, which is, I think, the right reportorial thing to do. She says, Dad, do you remember the time when Mom did this completely outrageous thing? That was so bad. Why didn't you quit her then? So here's her. And it's a pretty good one. Here's her.
Because it wasn't like a mystery to like us that you guys like had problems, obviously.
Well, people who I knew but had not seen until recently, many of them have made the remark that they felt that your mother was very hard to live with.
Yeah, yeah, I'll say.
Now, why they would even know that or say that, I don't know, because maybe...
Mom had a lot of outbursts, you know, around Whittier, you know? Like, lots of fights and craziness.
So here she's being very unspecific, so this isn't going to get her anywhere. So now she finds the specific case coming up right here. And this does break him a little bit, because at least he joins her in the conversation.
Remember when she tried to buy the house without telling you?
Oh, I remember that, yeah.
What happened there? What happened when she tried to buy the house without telling you?
She forged my name.
Uh-huh.
And then the people sued us.
Uh-huh.
And they got a judgment against her. They couldn't get it against me because I had no knowledge of it.
What was she planning to do with that house? was she going to tell you that you guys were going to move?
Yeah, she told me on the last day, she said, this house we're buying.
She told.
I said, number one, we can't afford it. Number two, it's ugly.
Uh-huh. And that's not a good sign of a healthy marriage.
That's true.
Right?
Not a sign of a healthy relationship. That's right.
No. So how did you feel when she did that?
How did I feel? I wasn't very happy about it.
No. But you stuck with it.
Yeah.
Why?
I just did.
Do it again.
Why?
Why is a crooked letter?
Why is a crooked letter? That means I'm not going to tell you. But finally, after it was actually a very elegant set of parries and probes and swords, she finally cracks him. And here's the neat thing about this. I mean, because I was listening to this with a mixture of horror and admiration, to be honest. And it turns out that what was going on was that he felt that he had somehow made his wife not like him, and that it was his problem, and he was guilty, and he should do penance, and he should stick, of course. And I think, I'm wondering, like, why would Starley want to do this? And I hear, in this next section, I hear the reason why. Because she knew the answer, I guess. She knew that he was feeling badly. And so when you hear this, you'll hear her suddenly become the little girl that she really frequently feels she is. And when her dad says, I'm guilty, she leaps in. There's all of a sudden a little energy rise. And she says, no, you're not. You're not, Dad. And then you hear in her sighs and in her breaths, you hear a tremendous sense of empathy, which she has obviously been waiting to give out. And I'm making this all up. I have no idea. I haven't talked to Starley about this. But listen to this part.
It's quite a mystery why you fought so hard to keep this marriage together that you guys were never happy in. Like, never.
Because I felt that I was primarily responsible for her unhappiness.
Oh, that's not true, Dad.
Well, I'm just telling you.
I know.
You're asking me a question.
Yeah.
I'm giving you an answer.
I know. I just don't want you to feel that way.
Healthy people don't feel unhappy without a reason.
Yeah. But unhealthy people.
Yeah.
And there it was. The reason my dad stayed with my mom for so long. He didn't see her as being different from a normal person. He wasn't even thinking about it that way. He just saw her as his wife, and right or wrong, he had to stick by her. For him, that's what it meant to be married.
Let's say, for an example,
person,
male or female,
gets
into drugs or alcohol. So you say, well, now, you know, what did I do maybe to cause this person to drink? You know, what did I do to cause this person to become unhappy?
Right.
To become moody, to become lethargic. To lose interest in life.
And you think that's what happened with you?
I was convinced that I was a contributing force, yes.
Yeah.
Give me half a second.
Okay.
Hold on.
At this point, my dad's line rings, and he has to take the call. So he hands up the phone to his new girlfriend, Ruth.
Hi, honey. How are you doing?
I'm okay. Are you listening to all this?
Yeah, it's very interesting. Some things I knew, some things I didn't know.
Oh, my God! He's having this entire conversation not only in front of the United States of America, that's her intention, but in front of the other woman, the woman that replaced her mother. I'm thinking, oh, my God, I couldn't believe. And then the two of them say, well, I didn't know that, and then it goes on. And it turns out that this Ruth person is a very nice lady. And that with Ruth, all of a sudden, Dad has got somebody who calls him up in the office, asks him how he's doing. They have wonderful. They go on trips together. They're going to Europe, blah blah blah. And they're very. It's very happy. It's all so normal all of a sudden. And now listen to the end of the piece, because the end of the piece is just. It's just so small and elegant and perfect. It's about the beauty of normal. Here's the very end.
It's normal.
Yeah. Normal's good, though, right?
Yeah, normal's fine.
Yeah. So that's a small, a beautiful ending, but it's earned very, very dangerously, I think. Another kind of danger. My partner on Radiolab, Jada Boomrod, we were working with Anne Hepperman and Kara Oler on a story for a show that Radiolab did about bodies and minds. The bodies and minds work together fluently all the time. That's why I can say, raise my hand, and up goes my hand, and so forth. There are occasions, however, and they're very newsworthy, interesting, and fairly paradoxical, when the body and the mind sort of go their own separate ways, and then all kinds of strange things happen. So in this show, we had amputees who kept feeling their arms still there. One particular amputee not only had a phantom arm, but had a phantom hand at the end of his phantom arm that was taking its phantom nails and cutting them into its phantom palms and hurting its phantom self. And the question was like, how do I get this thing that isn't there to stop behaving this way? These are very peculiar problems. But in the middle of the show, there is a story about pilots, a group of Air Force pilots who were part of an experiment done in the 1950s. The experiment was to try to figure out why pilots blank out, sometimes traveling in very, very dangerous and very high speeds with very high G-forces, and then somehow separate out from their bodies and look back on themselves driving the plane, which they're not doing anymore, and these are very expensive machines, and 9 pilots had died under these circumstances, so the Air Force wanted to figure out what was going on. The danger of this piece is not the story. The story is pretty interesting, but the danger is in the cut. Jad and Anne and Kara did things here that I just want you to listen to. Just the, this is a set, this is, a lot of this is run-on sentences. A lot of this is striking a narrative and never breaking the narrative. A lot of this is reducing full sentences and full sounds that ordinary people make into jazz-like beats, which come in, like in my own part in this particular piece, is I'm there to do things like this. Really? Ooh. I am basically turned into a musical instrument. However, so are a lot of people. And this is what happens when you have a reporter who's been trained as a composer, as Jed has, that you do get an intense musicality. Now, the music must flow out of the situation. The situation is very highly dramatic because people are going to be spinned around at extremely fast speeds. But everything that happens here, everything, is so articulate, and I am not personally capable of thinking up this stuff. And there's also some things in here which I don't, there are sentences constructed out of 7 people talking. So if I say, I cross the road, you have somebody saying I, someone saying cross, someone saying the, and someone saying the road. Certainly that should be very off-putting, but for some reason, having to do, I think, with its intensely musical organization, like anything complexly done, that's artfully done, it just sails off on its own. I may interrupt this from time to time, but let's just get it going. I think you're going to join this experiment at a time when we're going to begin putting pilots in a centrifuge, and the centrifuge is going to go round and round and create very, very big G-forces.
And then along comes this guy.
I'm Jim Winery.
Jim Winery is his name.
I'm at the Federal Aviation Administration Aeromedical Research Program.
And he had a radical notion. If we're going to really understand this, I mean, really get to the bottom of this, we have to induce this experience on purpose.
Make them go blank? Make them go...
Yeah, create the conditions that exist in a fighter jet on the ground in a controlled environment so they can study this. Mm-hmm. His idea was, let's put pilots in a centrifuge.
This big centrifuge.
Like one of these things that the astronauts use. It's got a 50-foot arm that spins round and round.
Round and around. And on the end of that 50-foot arm,
there's a cockpit.
A cockpit.
A pretend cockpit.
Mocked up to be exactly like what a fighter aircraft might be like, with all the controls, the screens, the throttle.
That's where the pilot sits and gets spun around real fast.
I see.
So Winery put out a call for volunteers.
I'm Tim Sestak.
Commander Sestak.
I met Dr. Winery.
He was one of the ones that...
got involved in his research.
Heroically volunteered to fly the centrifuge and to deliberately knock himself out.
Scared? Pilots don't do scared.
3, 2, 1, pressure.
This is a recording from the experiment.
The task was to chase this little airplane. So I'd sit there and you'd follow it, and first couple maneuvers would be... You know, 3 G's.
G-forces is the...
Well, it's like when you're on a roller coaster.
5 G's.
that force that pins you back in your seat?
Yeah, yeah. Seven Gs.
Except really on
a roller coaster. Let's stop for just a second. You see, in each one of these sentences, I ask a question, he partly answers it, someone else partly answers it, he picks it up. There is nothing like the satisfying cadence of grammar. Instead of you've left grammar behind and you're truly into jazz, this has not got any of the normal verbal reference points of ordinary speech. You don't particularly notice. It seems to now have its own logic, just like the logic of a piece of music. Once you're into it, you're there, and then all the old rules fall away. Let's keep going.
Except really on a roller coaster, you're only ever going to experience about 2 Gs.
And then 9 Gs.
Nothing like these guys.
The high G forces hurt. The skin on your face sags, your eyelids sag so low that you can't see out from under them. And you wind up tilting your head back to look out from under your own eyelids that are sagging down in front of your face.
Meanwhile, you're tensing all your leg muscles and your abdominal muscles and your arm muscles as hard as you can.
You learn to use your body to fight it. And what you do is you tense every muscle from your toes to your calves and thighs.
Push it out. Push it all the way up. All the way up. Okay.
And you take a breath.
Get the breath.
And you start to say the word hook. And you hold it for 3 seconds, and then you finish it off by finishing the K of the hook.
So these pilots, they sound like they're wrestling or fighting or something. Hook. And they're grunting and groaning. And
stop for just a second. I think some of this was actually reconstituted, obviously, because they don't have it from the... We have the tape from the original 1950 stuff, but this is... But you see how the... Here we stop for 3 seconds. That wasn't 3 seconds. It was like 1.5 seconds. He was breaking his own rules right in front of you. Let's stop for 3 seconds. And so on again. And then... That whole thing and all the sounds gathered at one end. So you're like you're coming around the roadway, you know, and nothing. Something happens over there, and it's like that's. I just love that. And like those of you I saw midday today, like listening to stuff, you know, and wanting to have it and make it up yourself. Like I listen to these things, I think I want to do this. I want to do this. So I can't. So I just stand next to them and say, "So I think that was okay. I think it was okay." Let's keep going.
Making all these hook noises.
It's like that.
The most G I've ever pulled was 12.4 Gs.
Just to give you a sense of what that might feel like, for a pilot like Tim Sestak, who weighs about 200 pounds, once he makes a 12.4 G turn, his body goes from 200 pounds to almost 2,500 pounds. So that's like over the weight of a car.
Because of the pressure pushing down on him.
Yeah, exactly. More crucially, says Winery, those G-forces pull blood...
The blood...
...violently from the brain.
...is pushed from the head down toward the feet, and it pools in the abdomen and the lower extremities. And when it pools down there, it can't get back up to the brain.
And that's when the problems start.
Well, this doesn't sound very good.
No, Dr. Winery documented a particular sequence that happens when blood is pulled from the brain.
The first thing you lose is vision.
Usually the first thing to go are your eyes.
And you have what's called gray out. Or loss of peripheral vision.
And you start getting tunnel vision. And
then you go through blackout where you can see nothing.
You lose your sight.
And then if you take the acceleration forces a little...
Stop for a second. Because you see nothing. You heard that. You see nothing and lose your sight. You don't need to hear it. We all know what see nothing means. But lose your sight. It's just beats. It's just, you know, and working with somebody like this, it's like I'm not no longer in the language from which I come. And there is a sense, a little bit, as a co-author, of not quite knowing what you're doing. He knows what he's doing, but not always. And we sometimes get completely lost and don't know like what we've made, and it's very very long. At least we're together, and then Ellen's there telling us that neither of us have any. You know, we have a woman who is mean to us a lot of the time. But the danger of this is that, and this is the deep fun of it, is that you're telling a story. You're also inventing the way to tell the story. And then the double fact that you don't know, no one ever knows how to tell a story when you start. If you do, then you should quit immediately or because this job is to go outside and look at real things and then tell about them. And each set of real things has their own logic, their own noises, their own characters, their own sense of itself. So you can't use your tricks from the previous 7 times. You have to treat each one as a completely new thing. But if you're also treating language and beats and everything as new as well, you can get really in double, triple trouble. And while it's fun, it's very painful a lot of the time because you don't know how you're going to get out. I like to just leap ahead to the last one in my sequence, if you could. This last episode, can you do that? Can you just sort of run through? Good. This last one was sent to me by Jay Allison, and it's a one about which I have questions, but it's fascinating to me. It's about a kid named Rogelio Bautista, who lived in Central California, in a town in California. He was shot and killed. And this was constructed by kids who knew him. Now, when you listen to it, you will hear that it is a pure piece of theater. It clearly has an adult touch, and probably Jay's, because it is beautifully, beautifully written. I think it's Jay's, but I don't know. I really don't know what this is. The story is about a boy who is shot, and then what happens next is his family and his friends find out that he's shot, and word passes, and then his friends, who are in a gang, are plotting revenge. Then the mood shifts completely, and the show asks, well, what does the dead boy want from the situation? The dead boy speaks in the form of an actor. The priest speaks on tape. Rogelio then is reduced to a little boy getting out of a car coming to America, and then the little boy speaks. There is no clear logical line here. It's just sort of a poetic logic. And then the piece ends very much like the we'll find a new way of living thing from West Side Story, where basically the question is there any alternative available to these kids other than a violent one? And maybe there is. So it could be a cliche, straight out and out. And I don't know what happened when I was listening to this. I thought it was deeply moving, even though there was nothing in it that seemed particular. I couldn't trust it. I wasn't sure whether the voices. But what I think I hear, and I'm just wondering what you'll think, is I think I hear kids who obviously, this sounds like the other version of this instead of West Side Story, this might be the chorus line of Street Violence. I bet you what happened was that they may have gotten all these kids who knew the dead boy to sit in a room together and each tell very personally what happened to them, maybe recorded it, and then wrote a script based on what. So the voices you hear, I'm assuming, are the voices of the people who are actually, they're talking from their hearts, but someone else is moving their lips. And it's one of those funny, tense things where you don't know how to hear it. But in that, there is danger. In these liminal spaces between what you expect and what you don't expect and all, that's where really interesting things happen. So let's listen to a little bit of this, which begins with the dead boy talking, I believe.
One of my brothers was there, at home, on Moreland, on New Year's Eve. I was hanging out, cutting cabbage or something, and a friend told me there was a gang fight on Barbara. I walked over there, just two streets down, but most of the people were gone when I got there. Enrique was also over there after people were scattering. He got in a fight, then went back home.
I was going to go home too, with Junior, 10 minutes before it all went down, because he was going to give me a ride home, but I wanted to walk home with my brother from Barbara Drive.
And there, on Barbara Drive, that's where the shape of my body is spray painted now, with green dots showing the steps that I took as I started rushing those guys.
No one knows what happened exactly at that moment. Well, maybe my brother Sergio, but he's not talking.
Some people say it was payback. Some people say they just meant to scare me.
Maybe the guy thought the trigger was locked.
Maybe he thought he was shooting somewhere else. Somewhere else, besides my head, where a bullet went straight through my skull, and then everything. The short story of struggle was over in a second.
That night, just a half hour later, Cesar was kicking it with his brother at his house, waiting for pizza to come. He got a call from Enrique. Enrique said, "Hey, Ramiro, Rogelio's brother had just killed someone, or done something." He's so dumb, Cesar said. He told his brother, and they were both like, "We can't believe it."
Stop for a second. See, sometimes when I listen to this, I can hear the kids reading the lines. So I think, eh. And then sometimes I just get sort of, I understand that there's a whole lot of going on, of things that go on in our own communities that you can't hear. There are two approaches to that. You can either get the kids who can tell their stories to learn how to tell it, or the shorthand version, I gather that Tatiana Harrison, who did this piece, is in the room, but so I can ask her in a minute. But something happens, as you'll hear, that it somehow gets below the level of performance, and you begin to sort of get scared for them, and you begin to get sad for them, and you begin to mourn with them. And I don't know why that happens, it just sort of does. Let's go on a little further.
A few minutes before Enrique made the call to Cesar, he had gotten a call from a cousin. Something had happened with Romito. He was with the cops. He was crying. Enrique had heard the shot. He was that close. But like everyone else, he was sure that on New Year's Eve, it was fireworks. So he was in his room, listening to Mr. Sancho. He answered a phone at 8:20. It was his cousin's mom's comadre. You always imagine these long emotional conversations, like in movies, at moments like these. But she didn't say much, hardly anything at all. She said, "Sit down." And he did. Sat right there on the floor. Rogelio died. He got shot, she said. Enrique only asked, "Who did it?" She didn't know. And just like that, after maybe a minute, he got off the phone. And there he was, sitting on the floor, this tough homeboy, crying for an hour. Then he went downstairs, sat on the couch, just sitting there, his parents next to him, watching that ball drop, not saying anything to him at all, clicking glasses of champagne, not saying anything to him, not anything at all.
My cousin Juan was sitting at his kitchen table with his family eating at about 11 o'clock. His dad got a phone call from his uncle. His dad didn't say anything besides, "¿Quién fue? Who did it?" But Juan knew it was me. Well, either me or one of my two brothers. Juan stopped eating his pozole birria, bowed his head, listened to the conversation. "Dios mío," said the people at the table. "No lo puedo creer." When people ask him how he felt at that moment, what he thought, he just says, "I couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe it." An hour later, he was still sitting at that table, but his family was in the living room, with the big parties playing on Channel 14, Dad sipping brandy, everyone staring down at the ground, plastic little Christmas tree as short as him, lights blinking on and off and on and off. Juan's dad went out to see the scene on Barbara. His mom went to sleep. And Juan, he's got a TV in his room, and his PS2 hooked up to it. Nice, huh? And he turned on the South Park movie on 57. He turned off the lights. His sister was already asleep across the room. And he was just lying there in the dark, watching this funny movie but too down to laugh, trying to get his mind off it till he finally went to sleep.
We could stop there, but there's something so acid and clean and sad about a boy sitting in a dark room, his sister asleep on the other side with the South Park movie on and not laughing because he's in such grief. So I let me conclude by sort of saying this, that I know a lot of you want to do this for a living, and it's really fun. And it's sometimes so fun that you just don't quite understand why anyone would pay you. Sometimes they don't. But there is something else to say about all this, which is there is a sense in which every time you choose to do something new, you're going to be reborn. And if you do this well, each time up, every time you do a new story, even if it's just going down to do the parade or talk to the mayor or whatever, each time up is a small or large, it's a little challenge, and it asks you to look and listen very, very closely and find the thing that you pick out, that you notice, that bounces out of the situation and hits your heart or your head or makes you angry or makes you sad or makes you suspicious. And everything then becomes very personal. And if you do this well, even if you're working in an organization which doesn't want you to be personal and wants you to sound like the others, the secret thing you do is you sound sort of like the others, but you put in a little bit of your heart somewhere in there, just a little. And if it's there, it's like a marker. It's the IOU to your soul. And sometimes they let you sing loudly, and sometimes you have to sing soft. But you keep singing. You never, ever stop. And if sometimes you know, you run a long dry line and you think, I don't know, I've been doing this too long or whatever, then switch your subject, switch your beat, switch your attention, switch your time to go from long to short or short to long, switch, and then the whole world gets turned on again. You should be in a permanent stage of love and a permanent case of terror. It's not for everybody, but you will kind of discover, if you're one of the ones who are lost to it, that you just can't give it up, that it just keeps tickling you. It keeps making you feel privileged and lonely all the time. So that's my comments. I would, however, take any questions anybody wants to ask. And I should ask, but I want to ask one before we start. I want to ask Tatiana. Where's Tatiana? Is she here? Tatiana Harrison? All right, maybe not. Okay, but I wonder just how much I mauled the system, but yeah.
When something that I notice in your pieces is that your writing's very snappy and it's very lively, and so you weave in all these characters, but you're the main character in most of your pieces. And, you know, if you're really, really experienced and you're really kind of dynamic on the air, that works. But if you're just starting out, I mean, do you think that there can be a danger where, you know, you're interviewing all these people and you're trying to get their story out of them? If you insert yourself, where do you find that balance, especially when you're just starting out, between, you know, being a very interesting character in your piece and drowning out people who are the main characters?
I think the proper posture is to be far away. The proper posture is to be invisible, usually. When the subject is very, very hard to find, if it's a complex and abstract subject, I often have to step in because, you know, you can't see a proton or a protein or whatever it is I'm talking about. But in general, I think a modest posture is the right one. And certainly, you never do these things from an inner sense of discomfort. If you feel you're in your ear that you're too loud, too forward, too noisy, too present, too intrusive, too there, then you pull yourself back. In a way, it's a private conversation you have initially. Then you show it to somebody, an editor if you have one, or a friend if you don't, and say, you know, but you're, and if the guy or the woman looks at you kind of cross-eyed at different points, then you notice those things. Because, you know, there is such a thing as being reportorially impolite, like talking too much at a party. And so you don't want to be that. You know, it's not really about you. Although, there's a fairly, at NPR there's been a complaint that I'm a little bit too forward in what I do. And also it's a very dangerous edge, because if you go over the line and if you have too much fun or whatever, then the audience gets mad at you, just as they would get mad at someone at a party who is ruining it for everybody else by making too many noises. Yeah. So you have to be careful.
I have two questions, and I'm greedy, so I'm going to ask them both, although they're completely unrelated. Okay. First of all, do you do your own technical work with radio? It's increasingly a demand on those of us who produce for different shows. And second of all, can you talk about why you're still spending some time at ABC? Do you think that network television news has redeeming value, and do you feel that there's some soul satisfaction in doing that?
To do the second question first, I think what really happens is when you do this, this seems like you talking, but it's a very collaborative business, radio or TV, so you find other people to help you, and you build up a body of work, but you also build up a body of affection. And I've always tried to like the people that I work with. Sometimes I'm quite emotionally sloppy about it, and I love the people that I work with. You know. Literally, which is very problematical. I don't mean I jumped into bed with them or anything, but I love them. Boys, girls, doesn't matter. So this has a couple of effects. One, it makes things sometimes emotionally difficult. But the other thing is that I get very good friends. So Charlie Gibson is the guy who's the current Peter Jennings of the moment, has been a very good friend of mine. And so I feel, you know, I just like him. So I like going over there and we, you know, hit each other over the head and things. And then we go in and I do the thing. And I feel like it's like a gift we keep passing to each other. So it isn't really out of loyalty to the company. I think, and same with NPR, you know, I don't think any of you should get too devoted to any company, ever. The way you survive doing this, I think, is you form alliances. You go to work and you see somebody over there who's really good at something, not necessarily what you're good at, and you kind of try to seduce them because maybe you could learn it or eat them or gobble it up or steal whatever it is they got. If you can like them at the same time, that's good because then they become your friend and you can steal from them more easily. And then you form a kind of loyalty, and loyalty must be real. And then, you know, your boss changes, the company folds, the dot-coms go away, the money comes in, you switch, da, 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 and there they are. It's not a big industry, so there you are again with these same people. And what you end up doing is saving each other constantly. You're the ones. And so the way you survive in this is you work horizontally. You have people who help you. You help them. I take this very seriously. And part of actually the notion of Radiolab has been to sort of see whether, you know, Jed and I can create a space to which other people could come and work. And where would you, the amount of real estate available right now for complex storytelling is growing smaller because of the commercial networks being so frightened by the marketplace at the moment. And the bloggers are living in kind of tents of one. You know, it's a kind of unitary for the time being. So the tents of the many are a little bit rare. Many where the interesting and valuable and challenging work is going on. So, so I hope to save a lot of people in a combination of affection and of some kind of, you know, sense of power or, you know, look what I can do, sort of thing. And the first question was, do I cut my own stuff? NPR uses a program called Dalit, not Pro Tools, which is horrible, but I learned it. And first of all, I couldn't bear having Jad do all, have his, I mean, his fingers move, I don't even know what's going on, but it's a little bit like saying, can you teach me the violin? He goes, sure. How about, so I think, well, no, I can't do that. So I feel a little under eligible for this. So I decided I would, because when I was in the earlier NPR thing, I was doing the razor cuts, as everybody except for Fresh Air has stopped doing, now Fresh Air even. So yes, I learned the Dalit, and I do. What I do is I make all the cuts myself, I write the thing myself, then I take it to Manoli Weatherill, my editor, and she says, no, this is terrible, and then I, or whatever, and then I do it over, and I hear that it's terrible, so we make a version, and then I go usually to Robert Smith, who sits behind me, or Adam Davidson, who sits across the whole thing from me. I say, could you listen to this? I actually have my, before any editor hears it, I've been edited by my editor, my tape editor, and by my colleague to the left or to the right, sometimes two. I call them virgins. I say, I need a virgin, now, meaning that they haven't heard it before. And that's what I do. So they listen to it, and then I send it in, and then they correct it. And so there's like essentially three levels. But I do want to make the first cuts myself, because I would feel like I wasn't in the business if I didn't have my hand in it. In ABC, you're not allowed to sit at the editing machine. It's a jurisdictional rule. But I sit there and, you know, irritate the, you know, breathe on the neck of the person. Yeah.
Are there certain stories that you... Do you save your energy for certain stories and let others be just, do you leave the notion of something or just write through the other ones?
Well, I'm in a very, very privileged position. I am a self-assigned reporter at all my places, except for with Jad and Ellen, where I'm told what to do some of the time. But so everything is my fault. And essentially, I have to make a living by selling into either system. I have to get All Things Considered or Morning Edition or World News to buy them. So no, I have to treat each one as a customized object for sale. So it's not like I get a guarantee, I make 20 necklaces and someone's already, each of my necklaces is up for grabs and I could have an inventory I can't sell, and then you get fired. If you know, if you got too many necklaces and no one wants to buy them, you're actually not in the jewelry business anymore. Okay, I think that's it then. Well, thank you very, very, very much for coming.